I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics.
This week, we're talking about the Harvey Weinstein story and how these accounts of sexual assault and harassment are not exclusive to Hollywood.
And we'll be taking a look at Willow Creek Community Church, one of the country's largest and most influential evangelical megachurches, and its decision to appoint Heather Larson as lead pastor once senior pastor Bill Hybels retires next year.
And for our deep dive, we'll take on the Values Voter Summit in Washington, D.C., an annual conservative, religious right political event sponsored by the controversial Family Research Council that happened over the weekend.
Before we get to our main stories, every week both Nish and I will share some news we've been following.
Amy, what's been on your mind? What have you been following this week?
Well, compared to everything going on in the world, you know, hurricanes, fires, potential nuclear annihilation, this story may seem like small potatoes, but stay with me, I promise. I think it reveals a potential split that would be incredibly damaging for the Trump administration. And it's also a pretty interesting window into how the president himself and the people around him think about religious communities and their relationships with them. So Calista Gingrich, who is the third wife of Newt Gingrich, was named by Trump back in the spring to be his ambassador to the Vatican. And now the Senate is voting on her nomination this week. The U.S. and the Vatican actually haven't had diplomatic relations for very long, only since like the early 80s. But the ambassadorship has been considered pretty much a plum post. It's one that most Catholics would be really happy to have. Sometimes it's been considered a reward for like a loyal Catholic Democrat, a former Boston Mayor Ray Flynn, Lindy Boggs, the late congresswoman, who's also Cokie Roberts' mom. George W. Bush kind of raised the bar when he picked Harvard Law professor Marianne Glendon. And then during Obama's administration, he first appointed a theologian, and then in his second term, he picked the former head of Catholic Relief Services. So some pretty high-level people have recently held the position of ambassador to the Vatican. To put it mildly, Calista Gingrich is an underwhelming choice. It's kind of a slap in the face to the many conservative Catholic intellectuals who are in the U.S., say a Robbie George or George Weigel. And it's along the same lines as the kind of exclusion of Catholics from the inner circle of religious leaders that Trump has been listening to and inviting to the White House. We've seen evangelical pastors show up maybe almost half a dozen times so far to be wined and dined in the White House. But there hasn't been a Catholic among them, as far as I know. And I think that that's intentional. I think it's intended as a diss. Robbie George and George Weigel were and still are both never Trumpers. And as far as Trump is concerned, the Pope has unfairly picked a fight and attacked him. That's his take on it, at least. The bishops have denounced his refugee ban. They hated the plans to repeal and replace Obamacare. So I'm pretty sure this comes down to Trump only being able to think of Catholics as opposed to him and evangelicals as his friends. In fact, I'm sure if he thinks of them at all, he thinks that they should have just been happy with a Supreme Court pick and really have nothing to say after that. So this pick is out there. And what it may well do is just be the last straw to kind of undermine any support that he still has among conservative Catholics.
Do you think that this shows Trump's ignorance on, I mean, just religion in general, but specifically, like, it seems to me that the only one that he's even remotely paying attention to is kind of the evangelical world. To me, it highlights his ignorance of the impact of other faith groups on politics and all that stuff by nominating Calista Gingrich. It's like, really? There are so many other people that would have been more appropriate for that job, but he literally would have no idea. So do you think that that is a piece of it, I guess?
I think that's a big piece of it. I mean, it's fair to say that There are a lot of subjects in which he is extremely dependent on advisors because he just lacks the knowledge and the experience in those issues. We could go on and on, but on religion particularly, he's very vulnerable just because he doesn't have any idea. I mean, the story that keeps coming back to me is his visit to a church in Iowa during the caucus period, before the caucuses, and, you know, they passed around communion and he tried to put money in the communion plate. So this is not a guy who even probably could answer what separates a Protestant from a Catholic. I mean, those kind of very fundamental pieces of information about religious groups. So, you know, his friend Newt Gingrich wants his wife going to the Vatican. He says, okay.
Sure, why not? You're Catholic, that's enough credential, right? Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and yet in the past, certainly if this had happened under a Democratic president, Catholics would be up in arms and conservative Catholics would be yelling about what a slap in the face it was to their community. I haven't seen much. I'm sure nobody wants to stand up and actually say out loud, by the way, Callista is not qualified to be ambassador to the Vatican. But nonetheless, I think it is emblematic of just the real tensions that exist just under the surface. And he's lucky they have not come up yet. But, you know, you poke the Catholic bishops and you do it at your peril. Nish, what story caught your eye this week?
So the story that caught my eye this week was a story on BuzzFeed News, and it was written by Molly Hensley Clancy, and it was a look into Bethel Church in Redding, California, particularly their School of Supernatural Ministry is what it's called. Students actually call it Christian Hogwarts. Bethel Church in Redding, in a lot of ways, is kind of the heart of what we would call the charismatic movement in America. And charismatic, what I mean by that is people who believe that quote unquote signs and wonders, so acts of the Holy Spirit, are present in the world today. So things like miracles and healings and prophecy, that those are spiritual gifts given to the people of God, and those things are still active. There are some denominations that believe that they died off with the apostles, some after, but Bethel believes that those things are still happening. And not only are they still happening, but you can be trained to do those things. You can be trained to heal. You can be trained to prophesy. You can be, all that stuff. And so, they have students from all over the globe come to this school and learn how to do these things. Kids from China, South Korea, all over the like South American continent. It's a very global place.
And is this fairly recent, or did this start up a long time ago?
No, this started up a while ago. And so it's fascinating to kind of see it take shape and like watch this thing kind of grow and happen, and how Bethel in and of itself, like this kind of modern charismatic movement, is one of the things, like we look at all the trends in kind of Christianity in America, right? And it is in decline kind of across the board. But Bethel is not. Like Bethel just keeps growing, and this kind of modern charismatic movement keeps growing, especially among young people, which is phenomenal in its own right, because we look at millennials and, you know, the groups that we would call the nuns and say, you know, they don't participate in like regular religious practice anymore.
Yeah, Christianity's brand is very bad among millennials.
Oh my gosh, so bad. And frankly, for some good reasons. And so, right, yeah. And so watching what's happening with Bethel is fascinating in its own right. But this particular story in BuzzFeed talking about and investigating this school of supernatural ministry. I don't want to give it away. Like there's a lot that she reveals, and that you have to go read it. I'll put it in the show notes. It's a fascinating glimpse into the school and her experience. So she walks into Bethel and wants to participate in kind of their healing practices. She had just had knee surgery after playing soccer. And so she says like, okay, well, I'm going to go, you know, get healed, right? And it's her, and like at the end, it kind of talks about her experience with going through their like healing process at church and what that looked like for her. And then going back to, I think New York is where she's from, and meeting with her physical therapist. Anyway, it has this like great little twist at the end, and it's fantastic. Really great piece. But anything that kind of has its eye on the charismatic movement, I like to say I'm a closet charismatic. many of my friends are like, there is nothing hidden about your charismatic side. But anything that kind of has that bent, I'm going to have my eye on. And so it was really, really fascinating. It was a very well-written piece, very thorough. It also talks about the impact of Bethel in the Reading community at large. What outsiders think of Bethel, and, you know, the role that it's playing in education and politics and economics, all that stuff. It's really great piece. Definitely go read it. I recommend it.
So we're going to move on in a sec, but I'm really interested in the idea that if you can train people, then having a charismatic gift is not necessarily something that is ordained from God, but something that you can acquire, which has not at least been my understanding of charisms. But
yeah, and that's kind of those big theological questions that people ask about Bethel and kind of, you know, raise red flags about, right? Is to go, well, the prophets in the Bible were called. Like this was like a calling on, you know, from God. And so,
right. I could see the objection that's a handy money-making scheme you've got there, telling people that they can acquire these gifts.
Exactly right. And so there's definitely red flags there. And yet the flip side of that, I've heard, you know, arguments for it, saying like, well, you have all of these people who for a lot of time have believed that like these gifts are not on the earth anymore. And so this may be their first exposure to it, to even just learn about it, let alone, you know, learning how to do it, that people may not even know that they have that gift because, you know, of their cultural background, religious background, family, I mean, all that kind of stuff. And so I've heard arguments on both sides, and I think that they're both pretty compelling, but it definitely like, I mean, if you're already a skeptic of like the charismatic movement and just Christianity in general, it certainly doesn't paint a great picture. So,
well, you've convinced me it's worth a read.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's definitely worth a read. So go read it. She did a great job.
Well, let's move on and talk about the big stories of the week. First, we can't not talk about the Harvey Weinstein story. Just over a week ago, a massive story broke in the New York Times about the powerful Hollywood movie producer Harvey Weinstein. Several women came forward accusing him of years of sexual harassment and assault. And since the Times story published, a second story broke, written by Ronan Farrow, detailing episodes of assault, harassment, and rape. And interestingly, largely from additional women. There wasn't a lot of overlap in terms of the women who were willing to speak to the reporters from the New York Times and to Ronan Farrow. And the New Yorker also included an audio recording of Weinstein that had been handed to the authorities.
Yeah, and actresses from Gwyneth Paltrow, Angelina Jolie, Ashley Judd, Rose McGowan, Asia Argento, Rosanna Arquette, and Kate Beckinsale. I mean, there's more and more have bravely stepped forward and have told their stories to the press. And more keep happening and keep rolling in every day. The thing that has been interesting to me is the public response from women, particularly women in conservative Christianity, saying, hey, this isn't just a Hollywood problem, which is fascinating. It's not fascinating that it's not just a Hollywood problem. It's fascinating that people are talking about it, because I don't know about you, but I've seen a lot of evangelical women stepping out and putting their hand up and saying it's happened to me too. And these sorts of things have been historically pretty quiet in the church, but it seems to me like this may be a tipping point in being open and honest about sexual assault and harassment.
It's true. I think, you could either see this as setting up the tipping point, or as, if you wanted to be more pessimistic, proof that talking about it still doesn't accomplish too much. The timing of this was really interesting in that I believe the New York Times story came out exactly a year after the Access Hollywood tape was revealed and ran. And that That was the first time that I started noticing evangelical women kind of standing up and saying, this happened to me. And being motivated almost less by Trump's particular story than by the almost complete silence with which male evangelical leaders greeted the release of that tape. There weren't a lot of folks who stood up and tried to justify it or apologize for Trump, although there were a few who kept making references to, like, locker room talk, King David was a womanizer and an adulterer, we're not electing a pope. But it was more the complete silence on the topic of sexual assault that just was the straw that broke a lot of evangelical women. And both you and I have watched this kind of happening and the consequences over it the past year. But I'm interested to hear from you what you have seen come out additionally since the stories about Harvey Weinstein, because it really has gotten people talking again.
Oh, yeah, big time. And I think, I mean, one of the things that I've been noticing, I mean, there's been several hashtags. Like, there was a boycott Twitter movement that happened over the weekend that a bunch of white women, majority white women, participated in. And right now there's also a hashtag happening on Twitter that's hashtag Me Too. And so any woman who has experienced sexual harassment, assault, or rape, you know, says just hashtag Me Too. And the interesting thing to me, and the heartbreaking thing to me, like overwhelmingly heartbreaking thing to me, has been watching so many of my colleagues in the evangelical world talk about, yeah, hashtag Me Too by my pastor, or hashtag Me Too by my youth leader, or like, this happens, this isn't like not only just not a Hollywood thing, like this is happening in our churches, in a place that is supposed to be, you know, like a safe haven.
Right. So there are two things going on here. One is just the willingness to talk and even care about sexual harassment and sexual assault in general. And the second is looking internally and acknowledging that this is going on within the church and asking tough questions about what it is about the environments of a lot of churches that allows these things to happen, all the different power imbalances. I mean, a Hollywood producer has a lot of power, but so does your spiritual leader. And right now, just before we logged on to talk, actually, a piece went up on the Washington Post that's also on Christianity Today's website called hashtag Me Too, I was raped by my pastor.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it is so prevalent. Like, it's everywhere you turn. And the interesting thing to me as well is watching evangelical men's response. Because so many women are saying Me Too, I have seen multiple men say, I knew this was a problem, but I didn't know how pervasive it really was and how it impacted every area of a woman's life. And so while, you know, hashtag activism gets, you know, a bad rap in a lot of ways, if it does make more men aware of the problem, more men and women. I mean, I should say that because there are men who experience sexual harassment and assault as well. And so the more that people realize that this is a problem, the more we can actually come together to combat different ways to address it. And so, it's been heartbreaking.
Do you think that there are men following this conversation? I mean, it's obviously not at the same intensity level that women are. But I wonder sometimes if we are living in kind of parallel social media worlds where, you know, this is all over my streams and your streams. But, you know, if I talk to some of my male friends, are they even aware that this is going on? Because you can't change people's minds if they're not even listening to the conversation.
Right. I mean, in my experience and what I have seen, yes, I think men are paying attention. They're paying attention because you honestly can't ignore it. Like, it's on every, you know, front page of the news. It's on, it's everywhere. And, you know, when it's, what, 1 in 3 women, I think, is the statistic who has been, you know, harassed or assaulted. So for how many women are actually talking about it, it seems to me that you'd have to work really hard to ignore it and not at least know that it's happening, if that makes sense.
Is it going to take, though, a major figure? Like, I'm thinking last year, Beth Moore was one of the people who spoke up right after the Access Hollywood tape came out. She tweeted, I've got her tweet here, it's from October 9th, 2016. She said, "I'm one among many women sexually abused, misused, stared down, heckled, talked naughty to, like we liked it. We didn't, we're tired of it." And she had had it. She had a couple of tweets that got a lot of attention. And for those listeners who don't know Beth Moore, because her name may not be the one that you hear as much as some of her male contemporaries, but she is a huge deal. She sold millions and millions of books. She gets enormous crowds everywhere she goes. She has a popular national radio program. Like, she is a big figure that should be a household name.
Big deal.
And is a household name in many evangelical homes.
That's exactly right. I don't know if, you know, having a big name, you know, come out and say something will really, like, turn the tide on how men treat women. I mean, it could help, but I think it has to be a both and, you know what I mean? Like, it has to be prominent evangelical figures, both men and women, coming out and saying, like, we have to change the culture of, you know, sexual harassment and assault against women, for sure. But the other thing is, we have to, and I know this may sound trite, but it's true, we have to start raising our kids to say, you can't do that to women. Like, that's not how we treat women. You know, men have to treat women better. We have to treat each other better. We have to change the culture from the bottom up as much as we have to change it from the top down. And it has to be, you know, talked about at a local level in independent churches as well. So I think it's not a, you know, silver bullet. I think it has to be, we have to attack it from all sides and see where it gets us. But that's my hunch.
Well, you touched on something that I can't let go before we move on, which is part, I think, of why this has struck evangelical women in particular so hard, which is the fact that in most evangelical churches that I'm aware of, there's a lot of talk, particularly for young girls, about how to keep themselves pure and how to take care of their bodies and how to make sure that they're not tempting people. There is little to no talk directed at the young men and boys and adult men about how to treat women, other than, you know, maybe taking care of your wife and appreciating her as a wife and mother. There's certainly not anything that would be useful teaching for men and boys.
Right. Yeah, that's a big piece, is that it's that, like, purity culture, rape culture mentality, that if a woman gets assaulted or harassed or raped, that she somehow deserved it, right? That, like, how she, you know, we have to take into account how she dressed, right? That, like, we have to take into account, you know, the vibe that she was putting out at the bar, right? Or, but the, and what that does is it, you know, truly, that mentality lets men off the hook time and time and time again. And it says that, like, somehow women are responsible for their own harassment and assault, and it is abhorrent. Like, it cannot happen anymore. And as much as churches want to talk about purity culture, modesty, and all that kind of stuff, there has to be an equitable side to young men and boys being told that, like, you can't speak to women that way, you can't touch women that way without their consent. Like, we have to have big conversations about consent. We have to have big conversations about controlling your own impulses. You are in charge of your own body. And what that means. So it's a huge knowledge gap. It's a huge knowledge gap. I know every single woman in the church who could tell you stories and stories and stories about, you know, being taught about modesty. But I don't know a lot of guys that were talked about consent in the church and why that's important.
Let's move on to story making waves in the evangelical world. Bill Hybels is the senior pastor at Willow Creek Community Church. And we should explain that Willow Creek is a big deal in the megachurch world. It's often reported as being the first American megachurch. I don't know if that is technically true, but it's certainly been a very influential one. And Bill Hybels himself has been a very influential figure. He was extremely close to the Clintons, and he's been really a mentor and a leader to a lot of other church planters and pastors around the country. He announced this weekend that he's going to be retiring in 2018. That was kind of expected. But he also announced his successors, which was not as expected. In a huge move, Hybels announced that Heather Larson will be stepping into the role as lead pastor. And Steve Carter, who is also currently at Willow Creek along with Heather, is going to be taking the role as lead teaching pastor, which is a step under lead pastor.
Yeah, this is fantastic news for anyone who is an advocate for women's leadership in the church. Heather Larson taking the lead pastor role is expected. If you know Bill and Lynn, you will know that their support of women in ministry is not a surprise. They've been champions of it really since Willow Creek's inception. That's just kind of always been who they are. It's kind of been part of their ethos. And Heather has been functioning as the executive pastor at Willow for, I think, 5 years now has been her role, 5 or 10 years. And so she has overseen their, you know, multi-million-dollar budget, all of their sites, staff, those sorts of, you know, administrative type functions. And so, but to see Bill get up there and like actually make the announcement was really moving. Like it finally, I don't know, it's like it was just a really big deal to see it actually come to fruition.
This is going
to
sound flippant, but I mean it sincerely. It is like seeing Rey becoming the female Jedi.
Which is like, it's a huge deal.
Which is enormous. Right? Yes,
it's a
to
huge
have her be,
deal.
There's one thing to be running the church, and you're right, she is absolutely qualified. It shouldn't come as a shock to anybody, but to be the face of the church is a completely different thing just in terms of the symbolic importance.
It is a huge moment. And so Bill Hybels' role, he was the senior pastor, was his role. And he they divided his responsibilities into, you know, two different roles. So there's the lead pastor and then there's the lead teaching pastor. Bill was kind of doing both for, you know, 42 years. And so I think rightly so, they divided up those roles. Heather taking the lead pastor role, which is the more executive position, and Steve taking the lead teaching pastor role, which means he will be taking on the majority of the responsibility of the preaching on Sunday. But if you go on Willow Creek's website, it actually does talk about, like, there is actually a hierarchy, which I think is a misunderstanding that's happening around this story, is that people are saying, oh, they're co-leaders, they're co-pastors. But that's not really what's happening. There is definitely an authoritative structure. Steve reports to Heather. Heather is the one that acts as a voting elder on the elder board. So she, like, that's Steve's boss. So while the responsibilities were divided, and Steve will be the one who takes the majority of, you know, the preaching burden, I say that in a good way. It is a, you know, it is a blessing and a burden, right? To preach every Sunday. Heather's the top dog, which is awesome. So great. So I'm really excited to see how it's going to shake out. They are probably the biggest church that has adopted this model of doing, you know, kind of two sides of leadership. I think in the evangelical tradition, the lead preacher, like the person who preaches every Sunday, has also been the face and the leader of the church at large. And what Willow is kind of saying is that, no, you can, you know, you can be an exceptional leader and have the ability to lead an entire church, but not be the one that preaches. Like, those are actually two different giftings. Those are two different ways to serve the body. And so I'm really excited.
Which is actually, in addition to being an exciting development for people who are supporters of women pastors and women leaders in the church, it's a really healthy step for Willow Creek to be modeling as well. There is a crisis in churches right now with burnout, with suicide among pastors, with just a posse of self-care out there. and for Willow Creek to be modeling the fact that it is too much for one person to do everything. And that, in fact, as you say, there are different gifts that people have. We certainly have all been part of churches where a pastor may be extraordinarily gifted in one area and not at all in others. So this makes sense just from kind of an efficiency standpoint in terms of running an enormous organization, but also just from a human standpoint. I'm really happy to see that they are not setting up Bill's successor to fail, but in fact putting in place a structure that will support them and make it much more likely that they succeed and take Willow Creek into a really interesting next phase.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting to watch. And one thing that, you know, I love about Bill and Lynn, I've traveled to Israel and Palestine with Lynn. They're just, I mean, just an amazing family. I'm friends with their daughter, Shauna. Bill is the kind of quintessential pastor of pastors, right? Like his passion, his love is to develop leaders to go lead. And so it makes complete sense to me to watch Willow adopt this model, but then also to have Bill get up and say, I'm going to be investing the next year before I retire into these two leaders to make sure they are very well set up, that they are very well equipped. Like he's not like pulling the e-brake and being like, all right, you guys got it, I'm out, deuces, right? Like it's not the case at all. He's really taking the time to invest in them, make sure the transition goes smoothly. I mean, you have to at that level. Willow Creek is a massive organization.
And it's his legacy. I mean, he does not want to see it crash and burn either.
It's his legacy. And I mean, what a legacy it is. Willow Creek has done amazing good in the world. And so, but I say all that to, you know, also highlight, like, this is the character of Bill Hybels. This is who he is as a leader, is to make sure other leaders succeed. And so that is as big a part of his legacy as the church itself is, you know, making sure leaders have the tools they need to do their job well. So I'm really excited for Willow. It's a really big move.
Well, let's follow up that happy development with our last story, which I know we've both been itching to get at.
Yes, our last big topic is the Values Voter Summit, which is a religious right conference that happens in D.C. every year. And it's sponsored by the Family Research Council. This weekend, Donald Trump, who has been president for 573 years...
give or take a few.
He's been president forever, it feels like. He was the first sitting president to attend the summit. And he had some things to say, unfortunately.
And something I said so much during the last 2 years, but I'll say it again, as we approach the end of the year, you know, we're getting near that beautiful Christmas season that people don't talk about anymore. They don't use the word Christmas because it's not politically correct. You go department stores and they'll say Happy New Year and they'll say other things and it'll be red. They'll have it painted, but they don't say, well, guess what? We're saying Merry Christmas again.
Trump has an interesting history with the Values Voter Summit. He appeared for the first time 2 years ago, so in 2015, when he had already launched his presidential campaign, but when he was one among many Republicans running at that point. And, you know, every year, or at least every part of the presidential cycle, so probably 2 years out from the election, they do a straw poll. And all the candidates come in and pay homage to Tony Perkins and Ralph Reed and everybody else. And in 2015, Donald Trump placed fifth place in the straw poll. He was not popular. He was, in fact, booed by the crowd. And the Values Voters crowd, they don't really boo folks who come to speak to them. But he referred to Rubio as a clown, and Rubio was a favorite. Ted Cruz was the overwhelming favorite of the Values Voters folks, as he was as well among that crowd in the eventual primaries. But Ben Carson, Mike Huckabee, Marco Rubio, all of them were preferred to Donald Trump. last year, of course, he returned the Republican nominee, and it was a very different reception. He was hailed as the man who was going to be their savior. And I don't use that word lightly. I think there is a lot of idolatry and heresy going on with certain conservative Christians, and particularly conservative evangelicals, and this administration. It got so bad in the middle of his speech last year that people started spontaneously chanting, "Lock her up," which just kind of horrified me as someone who's watched a lot of Christian gatherings in my 15 years of covering religion and politics. That was the first time I had ever seen what is supposed to be a nonpartisan group really engage in very hateful rhetoric. But it was also where Trump really kind of pushed hard on the idea that all evangelicals really need is for him to get rid of the Johnson Amendment so that pastors, Nish, can finally be freed from the horrible burden that has prevented them from saying what they actually think in sermons. Because as we all know, pastors have just been biting their tongues all over America. And if I sound like I'm sarcastic about this, it is because it has been my pet peeve forever. There has only been one case ever, ever of a church losing its tax-exempt status because of the Johnson Act or Johnson Amendment. And it was such an egregious case that even conservatives don't really argue and defend the church in that instance. Just as a quick reminder, this past spring, Donald Trump said that he was going to be making huge changes, getting rid of the Johnson Amendment, saving Christianity. It turned out that they didn't really amount to much, as with a lot of his promises. But in this case, there's actually good reason for it, because it's a non-issue, a non-existent problem. So the solution to a non-existent problem is also kind of non-existent, because there's nothing you can do to fix a problem that isn't there.
Right. That's exactly right. The other thing that, like, it's just, it's so enraging to me, is the blatant hypocrisy on display. I mean, it is just astonishing to watch at the Values Voter Summit. Values Voter Summit. What values are we actually talking about? Because the last I checked, Family Research Council is really stoked on, like, family values, Christian values, right? Like, all of these things that we would, that conservative evangelicals forever have said are these, like, important values that hold up Christianity as this, like, moral authority, right? And then you have former Trump advisor and Bond villain, Sebastian Gorka. The dude sounds like a Bond villain. Can we say that? He sounds like a Bond villain. He says, and I quote, "The left has no idea how much more damage we can do to them as private citizens," end quote. Like, those are the values that you want to uphold, is to, like, your whole movement is to go and do harm and damage to people who disagree with you? Like, those are not even remotely close to what I would hold as Christian values. And so that is just, like, one small snippet, one small, like, microscopic example of the ways that evangelical Christians, conservative, white, evangelical Christians, the 81% that voted for Trump, have completely sold their soul to the devil. Like, they have sold the soul of their faith, and they are worshiping this golden, orange, horrible idol because he promised them what? A Supreme Court justice? Right? Like, that's really it. Like, it was all about the court. And yep, it was all about Gorsuch, which is a stolen seat, mind you, right?
But you know what? You were you point out how partisan Gorka was and trying to call on Christian values to aid and abet that partisanship. What is especially enraging is that this has been going on ever since Trump entered the race. Last year at the Republican convention, Pastor Mark Burns out of South Carolina gave the benediction on the first day. And in his prayer offered up to God, referred to Democrats as the enemy and called on God to defeat Hillary Clinton and her party. Now, I know there are probably a lot of people who think that that is normal, that that's what the religious right has been doing all along. And it certainly is not a secret that most folks on the religious right have seen Democrats as their enemy, maybe since its founding. But it's important to point out that this was completely unprecedented in terms of a public prayer at a party convention. Nothing even approaching this had ever happened before. And what I worry is that now that that precedent has broken, what is to bring it back? Like, we are just seeing bad behavior trumped by more bad behavior, trumped by more bad behavior, no pun intended there, among Christian leaders. And it's possible that one outcome of this is that it serves a very good purpose of drawing a bright line for everybody to be able to see, if their eyes will see, who is just involved in being a partisan foot soldier and who is actually caring more about religion than about politics and than about party. That's the glass half full look at this. But I really, really worry that we're going down another path, to mix too many metaphors there.
Yeah. The thing that I've been paying attention to the most, and that I've been trying to pay attention to more and more and more, as much as I can, is the perspective of minorities across the board, people of color, LGBT folks. And while this feels, I think, to a lot of us who have been on the inside of kind of white evangelicalism, who have like spoken out against Trump and said like, oh my gosh, this is horribly unprecedented, right? It's this whole other new thing that's happening. One thing that I have noticed is that people of color time and time again have said like, we tried to tell y'all, right? Like that this actually isn't new, that all of this was there. It was just hiding under a rock, and Trump managed to kick it over and make it acceptable and the norm. And so that's the other piece to me that I always have to sit and contemplate is go, is asking myself, does this feel new and unprecedented simply because I have been a part of that privileged subset that, you know, has not had to look at the underbelly of it?
It's a good point that the feeling is not new. The animus was largely always there, and that's worth acknowledging. And in fact, not just worth acknowledging, we have to acknowledge it. But I want to push back just a bit, because I think it is worth distinguishing between the feeling that was already there and the actions that were already there and the norms that are truly being broken, because they may have just been a very thin gloss over what was there and what was being felt, but it makes a huge difference when you have a pastor standing up at representing the people of God at a party convention and preaching the most explicitly partisan prayer that we've ever heard in politics. You know, this is normally a time for, you know, pretty vague offerings of blessings for the event. In fact, sometimes causes controversy just by the mere appearance of a religious leader that maybe you are providing religious cover for people of whichever political party you don't happen to agree with. But this went so far beyond that, and then was followed up, of course, a year later by this Values Voters Summit, which has just reached the point of being a Republican offshoot. I don't think people quite understand. I think I hear often, well, Obama had his supporters. He had, you know, folks from Black churches who were in at the White House. Even among Obama supporters in the religious community, it was not lockstep. He had people who were very unhappy with him over immigration and deportations. He had folks who were extremely upset. You know, we may have missed the entire fight over the contraception mandate. I mean, that really cleaved him from a lot of his Catholic supporters for a very long time and caused extremely bad feelings on each side. And we could go on, but, you know, it was not lockstep for Obama and his supporters in the way that it's just been kind of bizarre to me to see folks like Jerry Falwell and Robert Jeffress and Franklin Graham, who, you know, has stepped out to criticize Trump once, and it was over some private airplane regulations that he disagreed with, I believe. But on everything else, it's as if they took a solemn oath to never criticize him. And it's just, it's jarring more than anything else, because even Trump's secular but very hardcore conservative supporters are willing to criticize him sometimes. But these core evangelicals just will not step out of line.
Nope. They're drunk on power, right? Like, I don't, it has to be. I don't, I mean, that it's got to be a piece of it. It's got to be a piece of it. And like, I think back on, you know, they have the president's ear. They have that power of proximity to the most powerful man on the planet. And so that, I mean, that'd probably be hard to give up. I can't even fathom what that would be like. And that's not to say that these guys should be let off the hook, like not by a long shot. But I can see the why they would be, you know, for lack of a better term, drunk on it, right? Like you get a taste of it and you're not going to let it go.
We've had a good long initial conversation, but before we go, we want to leave you every week with a recommendation or two. Maybe take your mind off of the news of the world. TV show, a movie, a podcast. I'm going to go first this week. So I have been listening to this new podcast, and I did not think I had room in my podcast lineup for a new one, but I need to make room because I'm loving this. It's called The Irish Passport. I'm not even going to be able to pronounce both of their names, but Naomi O'Leary is the host with a friend of hers. They're both Irish nationals. And so I will admit, I started listening just to hear their gorgeous Irish accents. I can really just like have it playing in the background, and it makes me soothed and happy. But they're also both historians. And as someone who's really interested in history, I find that it provides a welcome break from paying attention to current events. But it's also fascinating. So the episode that I would recommend people start with to get into this is also the first one I listened to, which was taking on and then kind of busting up the idea that Irish were slaves, which is something you hear from the alt-right and from white supremacists a lot, is the idea that it's not just Blacks who were slaves in America. The Irish were slaves too. And it's always brought up as part of this argument of clearly the Irish were able to get over it and, you know, pull themselves up by their bootstraps. So if you've got problems now, it's because you're deficient and there was something about your community that wasn't able to succeed while we did. And they really, you know, I won't go through their points, but they just decimate the argument. But by telling a history that was completely unknown to me, I really had not had any idea about this part of Irish history and about what folks ended up doing, some of them, just in the severe economic trials and especially the times of famine. So I recommend that to everyone and just listening to their wonderful, wonderful voices.
I'm going to have to listen to that. I'm half Irish, so That is a very strong side of my family. The other half is Russian. I think I've been told I'm half Guinness, half vodka, but with like one hell of a temper. But that's neither here nor there. Okay, so TV show, my husband and I have been watching Narcos. If you haven't watched Narcos on Netflix, the first two seasons are about the rise and subsequent fall of Pablo Escobar in Colombia and the drug cartels down there. And then the third episode shifts over to what happens to the drug cartels in Colombia after Pablo Escobar's death and the rise of the Cali cartel. It's really well acted. It's fantastic. It is very violent. So, I mean, it is like, you know, Colombian drug cartel in the time of the 80s. So be aware that it is very violent if violence isn't your thing. But it's a great show. So we've been watching that.
Now tell the truth, Nish.
What?
Did you start watching Narcos because the vet Red Viper from Game of Thrones is in Narcos? Tell the truth.
Maybe a little bit. Speaking of Game of Thrones, it is not on the air right now, as many of you probably know, because I haven't tweeted about it. The actor who plays Jon Snow and the actress who plays Ygritte, the wildling, they just announced their engagement.
Yay!
So they're getting married. We're going to have a Game of Thrones wedding.
He does know something after all.
He does. That is true. He does know Ygritte. So they're getting married. And also Sophie Turner, who plays Sansa in Game of Thrones, announced her engagement to Joe Jonas, who I did not even know they were dating. This just goes to show how far outside of celebrity gossip I have been in the last few months. So,
yeah, maybe I need more Us Weekly in my life and a little less just news stories. But that's happy news. Congratulations to the actual people.
Yes. We just know them as their Game of Thrones characters.
But we're happy to see Sansa in a good relationship.
Yeah. Oh, thank goodness. All right. Well, that is all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for joining us. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please subscribe, and visit us on Facebook at Impolite Company, the podcast. We'd love to hear from you and get your feedback, and we will post the link there to our show notes, and we'll do that on Twitter as well. And until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.